Welcome to another episode of Born Secure Security Influencers. This podcast is about thought leadership in the application security space, both from the vendors and the actual practitioners in the trenches. Today, we talk to Nick Chalon. Nick, the first U.S. Air Force and Space Force Chief Software Officer, is one of the top thinkers in the DevSecOps space. Over the years, he has strongly influenced the DevOps and DevSecOps industry via a combination of highly popular presentations, live events, and articles. Often, his presentations stretch the audience limits of the most popular streaming apps. Since 2016, Nick has led multiple cybersecurity leadership positions in different agencies that are part of the Department of Defense, including the Air Force and the Department of Homeland Security. His background is rooted in the software development industry as a founder and CEO of multiple startups. Nick is truly respected and appreciated in the DevSecOps industry because of his forward thinking and also his transparency and proximity with the security community. You can follow him on Twitter and LinkedIn under his name, at Nicholas Chalon.
Nick, thank you for joining us. Welcome to our podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's go straight into a hard question. So we have a very large security budgets, many security vendors, some of them with very high valuations. Where can we write secure software?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, security is so difficult, right? First, you look at talent and engineers really not taught well how to do it, right? And so I think it starts with the basics. New programming languages, new ways of doing things create different kind of risks. The pace of IT is moving so fast. People are trying to compete, and there's not enough investment made in DevSecOps to have it baked into the process, right? When it's an afterthought, you have so much technology debt that you end up having to deal with months of issues, and not many companies are willing to say, hey, you know what, I'm going to take the time to take care of it. And instead, they keep pressing, keep adding more features, compounding the problem. So the more you can start day one with a full DevSecOps pipeline, proper scanning, proper testing, and really make this part of the process. And yes, maybe you're going to take a hit in terms of velocity of 5-10% every 2 weeks for your sprint cycles, but that's going to save you months of tech debt down the road. So it can actually save the entire company. You know, when you see some of the recent breaches, the impact financially on some of these companies is so drastic that effectively there is no choice today really but to do this. I think back in the day, people used to get away with it, and many companies had no impact when they had breaches. I think particularly for a smaller company, it is going to be a drastic impact. I think the bigger guys still get away with it, unfortunately. But I think the startups and medium-sized companies will not get a second chance. And so the more you can do early on and do continuously and have this part of your process, the safer you're going to be. And honestly, it has to do with continuous learning. And I used to give an hour a day to our people at Platform One to go and learn and not get stale and behind. You have to invest in your people, and there has to be some training around security and best practices in terms of full stack developers that learn effectively how to build proper software.
Very good, very good. So I think you mentioned developer education, you mentioned having the right DevSecOps methodologies, and I think actually that's how you became so well-known in the security community, in particular around DevSecOps at scale, okay? So, yes. Let's talk about that a little bit. So I think you manage one of the largest engagements for DevSecOps in the world, if not the largest, right? So how did you rank, how did you prioritize all the ideas that will come to mind in terms of, deploying this methodology across so many developers, so many organizations, so many teams? How do you rank and prioritize the initiatives that will come to your head?
Yeah, so that was a big issue, right? Because you're right, we are not, without a doubt, the largest organization on the planet. Probably 100,000 developers. You're also looking at the largest budgets, but also the higher risk. I mean, you don't want to mess up with space and weapon systems. So you want to do that right from the get-go. We don't get a second chance. It's not a mobile app that's going to crash and you know, make people upset. So that compounds the issues. For me, you know, security was always the first thing, but you also don't want to create an environment that's so secure that it's unusable. So you want to find the balance between the developer experience, right, the operation side, the continuous delivery, tracking the metrics, and having that baked in security day one. And so for me, zero trust was the first investment because I knew how important it was to really have that mitigation and the ability to mitigate and reduce your attack surface. So, you know, bad actors that potentially get into the system will not be able to laterally move too much, at least to your crown jewels. And so limiting that and tracking and having continuous monitoring and behavioral detection, AI ML, really pushing best of breed and decoupling, being modular, right, cutting into Lego blocks and being very flexible and not locked in. You know, I think for me, part of my role for the taxpayer and the warfighter was to make sure we're not getting locked into a cloud provider or to a single company or platform. You can afford that, right? Because you want to have diversity, you want to have options. you know, it's so much money. We shouldn't put ourselves in that situation. And so that was always important to abstract and to decouple and to cut and to be able to be modular and reuse and try to use best of breed. And really the foundation of open source was so important to me because I knew that the ecosystem and the, you know, the Cloud Native Computing Foundation partnership, we were the first, you know, government agency to join CNCF, right? All this stuff we've done was so essential, I think, for us to get where we wanted to be. At the same time, I can tell you, I probably achieved in terms of the full vision of what I had in mind from day one. So when I started, I think I achieved 10% of what I wanted to do. Because the tech debt and our current state was so bad, I had to like take a step back and fix the basics before even going to the real meat. And so I'm a little bit disappointed because obviously, you know, there's so much more I could have done. But at the same time, I guess, you know, I think what's important, I guess, is to prioritize based on very clear, you know, metrics. You wanna really think about what is really important, right? What is the outcome that you want to get to? And you know, for me, you know, security is essential, but at the same time, I think it was more about the balance between the developer experience, the usability, right, the user experience, and you know, the security. So it has to be balanced. If it's just secure and no one can use it, then you're not solving the problem. So I think it was a mixed. And there is so much more I wanted to do in terms of the cyber side of things, in terms of multi-party signing and you know, making the pipeline something you cannot try to bypass and make it even more ephemeral and cattle. So if a bad actor gets into your DevSecOps pipeline, which, by the way, is now your crown jewel, because if someone gets into your DevSecOps pipeline, they can tamper with your entire source code software, laterally move into many systems, many use continuous delivery as well, so they have the keys of the kingdom in their CI/CD pipeline. So all these concepts are essential, and so making the pipeline as secure as it can be. And in fact, I was always thinking of the DevSecOps platform as a weapon system.
Very cool. So you mentioned a lot of ideas there, right? You mentioned zero trust to limit the lateral movement. You mentioned metrics. You mentioned the adoption of open source to avoid these vendor lock-ins. So many other cool things. If you have to pick one, which one would you think was the most impactful of your contributions? I think
the
I have
open
one
source,
idea. But,
I think. Okay. Yeah, I think it's the open source. You know, because well, you know, of course, zero trust is important, but I think. Well, if you look at the adoption of what's going on in the service mesh space and Kubernetes, they bring zero trust, right? They think zero trust now. And so you would end up getting zero trust just by using the open source stuff. So I think overall, having access to that ecosystem and community and best of breed and not getting behind is probably the biggest impact.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I was going to do something similar. No, my looking at your work a little bit these last few weeks, I was very impressed by the stack you have put together, which is a very cool hip stack. I mean, that stack could be the stack of, you know, the latest hot venture capital funded startup in Silicon Valley. But you have managed to sell that to the largest, arguably more most conservative organizations in the world. How was that? How was the process of selling this collection of very, very hip, very cool, very new tooling into this one platform, if you want? That's how you call it, right? Your DevSecOps
platform.
Platform one.
So how, I guess, was a little bit mixed. I think there was a piece of education training for the engineers so they can see the value and understand the concepts of it. When I started, you know, I was talking about containers.
So you didn't have to ask for permission. You didn't have to ask for permission for anyone. You just recommended these tools.
Yeah,
and
you go all in. I mean, look, I think if you lead the way and you show it's possible and you start incremental and you grow and you crawl, walk, run, and you show the light. You know, when I started, people didn't even know what a container was. They thought I was trying to ship containers to Afghanistan or something, right? Like physical shipping containers. So there was a massive, you know, learning gap. And so, and then, you know, Savvy Smash, no one even heard of it, right? I mean, most people in DoD have not had an agile training, just basic agile training whatsoever. They still use Waterfall. So I mean, the barrier was huge. So we created all this training. We brought... created unbiased training because, you know, you have a lot of these companies providing DevSecOps stuff that have their own training, but it's very biased toward their product, right? So you don't want to use that. You want to bring more unbiased training. So we partnered with the Linux Foundation and CNCF and O'Reilly the Books to create content and make you know, create curriculums for different kind of persona, right, based on how much they wanted to learn. And so we created all these things. There was a lot of me selling. I mean, I was a sales guy, right? I was me, you know, doing briefs and public events and, you know, ask me anything events with 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 people sometimes, you know, talking about all this stuff and the benefits. And you have to lead with the outcomes, right? You don't want to talk about the container and the stuff if you don't explain what's the benefit, right? Why are we doing this? What do you get out of it, right? So you want to lead by that. Once people see the benefits and the outcome, you picking that you picked X, Y, and Z thing to do it, nobody really cares, right? And so the open source, I was surprised that I didn't get as much pushback as I thought I was going to get. And when we open sourced all of Platform One, by the way, back, which was the largest government contribution to the world, to history, really, it's an $80 million investment, right? So it's pretty, and it's something that, you know, when the government usually open source stuff is when they stop using it or they transition it. This is something actively used, right? So this is something that we still improve. That's more rare, right? The IC is doing some of that, but that's about it, right? So I think that was the biggest contribution as well. And you just have to lead the way and show it's possible. You know, the first thing I've done, people told me, why don't you start with something simple? I said, no, we're going to take, you know, the F-16 jet, 60-year-old hardware, and we're going to put QMAs and Savvy Smash.
I saw that.
And,
that
you know,
bunkers.
Right,
yes.
In 45 days, you know, and we're going to show it's possible, you know.
And running Python, I think.
Yep, Python, and I think there was Python, Java, and... I'm blanking. One more cool language. Go. And that hardware was running, you know, C and you know, C++ stuff before and Ada, right? Cool. So, and without changing the hardware, right?
That was the first language I learned in computer science, Ada.
Me too.
But yeah, anyway, we recommend, I guess this is European influence, right? We recommend the audience, and we add to the show notes this kind of ecosystem that I was talking about of tools and processes that that Nick shared, because it's actually very cool to see. We'll incorporate that into the show notes. So, yes. Switching gears to something a little more technical about application design, going up to the top layer. So zero trust has the implication that, you know, you can't make any assumptions in the application level about who's coming in, right? So how did the teams account for this in the design of the applications? How did they modify the authentication and authorization knowing that you were pushing for a zero trust layer? And how did you automate all this?
Yeah, I think the key piece to understand is when you start moving to zero trust in system-to-system communication, not just people with system, but system-to-system communication, particularly on the microservice side, and you start making them very small, but that compounds the problem. If you don't have the principle of ruthless automation, you're not going to succeed, you're not going to scale, it's not going to work, right? So first, for me, always was the principle of ruthless automation was the centerpiece of that engagement. And then the identity management and the ability to track the non-person entity, right, the system-to-system authentication was essential. So short-lived certificates, right, self-rotating, short-lived, right, automated. So we used Istio, right, we took the service mesh and we use Envoy as a reverse proxy and the Istio control plane to issue the certificates and rotate them and tie it to our PKI. We use Vault, you know, so we really designed the stack to be automated and streamlined. And then, you know, build the using the proxy layer, then you can create the proper rules. And you know, we started using OpenPolicy Agent and OPA to start doing some type of access control enforcement. And, you know, Istio is also bringing a lot of pretty cool new next generation access control capabilities as well. So you start to see pretty granular ability to create rules to define, you know, who gets access to what and when and how, all the way down to the data level with data centricity, you know, so like a field in a database could be, PII or PHI or whatever, and you don't get to see that, you know, based on who you are. So you can be very, very precise and not just talk about the north, south, and east, west traffic floating between the containers and the clusters, but also even within the data centricity aspect of the system, that you can, you know, start labeling things and using ABAC to enforce access to specific data fields and types. So that's exciting. I mean, when you start getting there, that's when your maturity is starting to really scale, and now you can do some pretty cool things.
No, I think it's very cool that you bring it down to system-to-system authentication and authorization, right? So the infrastructure could be zero trust, but there is a lot of kind of permission and authorization rules, as you said, going on, right? And this ties a little bit to infrastructure as a service, right? Something that you also are a big advocate about, right? Like automation takes you to infrastructure as a service, right? So basically all your infrastructure or your Istio networks or your Kubernetes networks are defined by code. So, you know, mm-hmm. everything is ephemeral, everything is very automated, right? Just to leave it there.
Yeah. GitOps, infrastructure as code, configuration as code. Absolutely, yep.
Yeah, and the applications, I mean, how do applications find out about this? I mean, because in my mind, you know, as a developer or as a recovering developer, the application knows not so much about the underlying layer. So is that something that it was part of the design, or it was something that emerged as, you know, that was the easiest way of authenticating and authorize?
Yeah, I think you have to make it easy, right? If it's the easiest way to do business, then, you know, application layers will consume it. And I mean, I would argue that's something you probably want to mandate anyway as a business, right? You wanna because of the benefit of zero trust and the ability to track what's going on, telemetry and the metrics you get out of this. So you know, if you build a good service, people will use it. But if they don't want to use it for whatever reason, that's the kind of things where identity management, particularly in zero trust, should probably be mandated. There shouldn't be two options. I'm, you know, when you think back on the DevSecOps stack, I had things where I had, you know, 23 databases, 16 programming languages, right? Plenty of options for different things. We had 900 containers on IronBank, right? But then some things where, you know, that's the one way, right? That's rare.
All of them share this vertical authorization, identity management, you call it, right? Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a few things that you probably want to mandate and have only one option. The rest, you may have a couple. Sometimes you want to have three or four. Sometimes you want to have 20, 50, right? And so you want to bring diversity to your development team, but you want to bring the right diversity And for some things, you know, if you look at zero trust, you cannot federate a policy enforcement point because the whole principle of federation would be to blindly trust the other PEP, in which case that's not zero trust. You're just trusting somebody else. And so if you start using two zero trust stacks that are completely disparate and they don't share policy as code in the same repo and same enforcement layer, then you really are just back to not using zero trust.
And this identity management layer is also open source?
Yeah, we use Keycloak, you know, then of course all the basics of, you know, JSON Web Tokens and you know, passing that to Istio with the mesh, and then the token had labels and access control labels baked in into the token. So then you can do very granular things. I could know like what device they use, you know, if they authenticated with the right multi-factor options based on what you use. If you're on a personal mobile device, maybe you don't get access to the same stuff that you need for your government device, right? So we had all these great mechanisms to then whitelist and grant access to different things based on the device use, based on the identity of the user, and the component risk. So me authenticated with my mobile device would not get the same access than me connecting with my government device. So that's when you get, you know, we call it comply to connect, when you enforce a device state, and we would check the patching state of the device, you know, check if it's up to date, all that stuff, if they have an endpoint protection software installed on it. And so that would rank the device risk posture and then tie this back to the user identity, and based on the component risk, then you know, you get access to different things based on the risk.
I think it's very cool to have that granularity, right? It's not all or nothing. It's not a yes or no binary decision system. It's based, as you said, in all these parameters. I mean, it's,
and you want to give this to the application layer. Yeah,
it's common sense.
You want to give this to the app, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's common sense, but I think the tech wasn't there. Up to a few years ago, I only heard this concept, I think it was in a Google talk, about exactly what you described. Basically, customize the access level depending on, you know, this matrix of, you know, confidentiality levels or secrecy levels and the security of the device that you're using, right? Having this matrix. I think it's common sense, but I don't think we were anywhere there just a few years ago. So I think it's very cool to hear that.
Google created the concept with Beyond Cope, and I kind of, I won't call it stole it, but I borrowed it.
No, I think it's common sense, and that's, I hear it first from Google, but I think this is the first case that I see it, you know, used at such a significant scale with, you know, so much at stake. So that's right. That's very cool. So yeah, I guess we end up talking about development, identity management layers, applications, and all that. So that takes me to the developer background of your experience, right? So it seems that it's a common pattern to have security experts that became security experts after being developers. or even founders of development companies, even launch companies. We have Larry McCrone last time, and he was, you know, first a huge developer and, you know, founder of startups. And I think in your case, it's also a very similar background. Jim Manico, also similar background. What's up with this combination? Do you think it's a huge requirement to be a very good developer, to be very good at security?
Well, I think it's certainly important to not just think security as the only important thing. So I think by being a developer, you want to take into account the user experience of the developers. And if it's not something you would use, then you're building a product in a vacuum. So I think it's important to balance security with user experience and ease of use and all that. So there's a balance, and it's competing interest, right? So I think it's good to have someone that's both a cyber guy and a software guy, because you can then find the right balance between the two. And you know, when it comes to innovation right now, with the move to GitOps and the move to everything as code, effectively all the cyber experts we will have to become somewhat of a developer to some degree, right? At least understand code enough. Because we're not going to connect to a Linux box and SSH and root access and patch stuff. You're going to make change in code in a Git repo, and the pipeline will be the thing pushing to the staging and production environment. Ideally, you should not have people in production, human in production anymore, and everything goes through the pipeline and you never bypass the pipeline. So that means all these cyber experts have to reinvent themselves to know how to make the same change they used to make by patching Apache on a Linux box, but by going into an Apache Dockerfile container and updating that container. That's a drastic change. That's a complete relearning of everything they know. It's the same outcome, but it's automated. It's no drift between environments. It's GitOps centric, and that's the future. And so obviously having software expert that are coming into the cyber world is going to make this happen.
That was a beautiful way of articulating that. I think I'm going to steal those sentences, but you know, in my mind it makes a lot of sense. I mean, why would you have someone SSHing into an Apache box and doing things in that specific box when you can, you know, just do that offline with all the security that you have, and when you are sure that that works and you are not exposing anything, then you repeat that into this automated fashion in the actual production environment, right? So that's a beautiful concept. I hope it grows as it's growing. Very good. So we are a security vendor. I just wanted to ask you, what's your opinion about the security, the application security industry, where the vendors are going? There seems to be a lot of capital flowing in the space, which is great for us. Do you think it's what's the reason behind this attraction of capital? Is there any application security technologies that you are excited about? You know, any standards, any new ways of doing things? So let's talk about application security as an industry.
Well, I think it's interesting because despite the fact that there's a lot of money flowing, I see very little innovation, right? I mean, IASP, right? I mean, we went from SaaS, you know, to dynamic application, you know, scanning to IASP and all these things. There's continuous monitoring aspects now, right? But honestly, I think everybody is still missing the point. Which is this GitOps move, right? For me, I think the future is with a company that's going to be able to become the next GitOps security company. What I mean by that is,
Can you define GitOps? What do you mean exactly?
So GitOps is effectively everything is in Git, right? Your source of truth, your declarative state, everything as code is in your Git repo. Your configuration changes, everything is in Git. So GitOps is that automation process to ideally pull from Git, not push, because that way your CI/CD pipeline does not need to have the keys to your production and staging environment. So we pull, we use Flux or ArgoCD, right, to do that. So you can pull from Git every minute to see if there is a change and apply the change. So that concept of pull from Git is essential. So you have no drift, no human in production. You have ephemeral state, your desired state is in Git, so you can audit at any time your Git repo and know exactly what was your state at a specific time, because you can go back in time, you can revert, you can do a lot of different things. So this GitOps concept is essential, but that's going to change the entire cyber landscape, and I don't see a lot of companies embracing it yet. What I'm talking about is, if everything is code, right, that means now companies should do two things. One is, we need to scan the runtime and see what's running on the cluster, compare with the Git repo, and see if everything is different, right? If anything is different from your desired state in Git and your source code and your runtime, so your source code being different from your runtime, that means either there's a malicious actor or there's someone that went in and, you know, made changes that they shouldn't have made, that bypassed the pipeline. So any difference between your source code and your runtime is a problem. To do that, you need to scan your runtime and see what's running and be able to scan your source code repos and match, you know, your Dockerfile, Helm charts, you know, Kubernetes manifest, all these things, you know, Kubernetes operators and all these things to what's running. And if it's not the same, then there's a problem. And then when you look at all these scanning companies, they often apply change in runtime in production. We don't want to do this anymore. We want to make the change in the source code. So now let's say they find, you know, they scan the runtime and they see there's this old version with a CV of Apache, whatever, right? They, instead of patching Apache on the runtime like they do now, they should push a merge request to my Git repo to make the change proactively, and then the human has to go and say, yes, I want to approve the change, that trigger the pipeline and deploy the updated version. So it's a complete shift from, you know, scanning the runtime and applying the change in production directly to proposing the merge request in my Git repo to apply the change and push it to the pipeline. But it also requires the application, the company, to be able to compare the runtime and compare the source code and see what's different. But so for that, we need to scan the source code and understand it enough and understand the YAML, understand all these code to know exactly what that would create in runtime to see if there's any differences.
Yeah, no, that's actually super cool. I mean, we are a runtime security company, and when we do demos, we actually start with that. We show them, hey, this is your deployment in production. This is what it looks like in terms of the environment, in terms of applications, in terms of CVEs. But we just stop there. We just say, hey, this is what you have.
That's the next step.
No, you study, have your next feature. Study it, right? So I guess the next feature is to understand that automatically. Yeah. No, that's very, very interesting.
But you have I would argue it's the hardest piece, right? The runtime, because scanning source code and Docker files and YAMLs is not rocket science, I think. So I think, you know, you can probably do the matching and then proactively look at drift and see, hey, you know, this thing running has a different stay in YAML than this YAML file. So why is that change? Why is that a hacker that got in and made a change, right? Maybe open ports or starting to run stuff it's not supposed to run, or maybe there's a container running that's not in the Git repo. So where did that come from? I mean, if there's a container running that you didn't have in Git, that's clearly an indication of a malicious behavior, someone installing stuff that shouldn't be there. So I think it's pretty easy to get there.
Yeah, no, we don't get so much at container level, but we really care, for example, about API discovery, which is more in our application layer,
sure,
right?
Sure.
So that's one of our, you know, key features for the next few quarters, which is just basically show you your endpoints, the signature of your endpoints, and what is the security posture of your endpoints. You know, you will be surprised like how many companies discover, you know, zombie APIs, old versions of APIs, dashboards that maybe they were considering for development. Of course, they end up in production without the right things.
Yeah.
So just that this visibility today in 2021 has a lot of value. Of course, 2022, 2023, that's very cool, right? Finding out a way of comparing the ideal state and the real estate, right? This digital twin and comparison,
exactly.
Right? So
that's a very, very cool. Right there, yep.
What else? So let's see, I have here, well, of course, I have a personal question about my interest, which is with your position in defense and geopolitics and all that. I like to follow that space. I think it's very cool. Maybe it's because of the movies that I watched growing up about spies and all that, right?
Me too.
The 90s. So I guess there is a growing trend of nation states using cyber weapons, right? At the beginning, it was mostly an espionage use of these tools, like basically just getting to a very specific target, analyze, collect information, you know, basically data collection, espionage. Then it moved to more sabotage operations, like very targeted operations where you hit a critical infrastructure and then you leave, right? So it seems that the natural next step is an escalation to a actual cyber conflict and attacks at a national scale level, right? And I don't want you to tell me anything that you've seen in your professional experience, because of course that's confidential. And I don't even know if it's a fair question to ask to separate these two points of view, but are you more concerned about nation states acting on kind of ideological or geopolitical motivations, or more like rogue groups acting with more economic motivations, right? So you have these two groups of bad actors. Which one is most scary in your mind?
Well, you know, you're going to find that many of the rogue groups are funded by nations too anyway, but not all of them, but some of them. I think I'm more concerned about the nation groups because they have different desired outcomes, right? The rogue groups just want to make money usually, right? Sometimes they want to make a statement, but that's pretty rare usually it's money. So money is, you know, they can get money and be done. They're not going to they're not going to put lives at risk or destroy things or kill people. You know, I don't think that that's a thing. But nation states could be a different story. So I think that is probably the biggest risk we're facing right now. And, you know, when people keep saying, you know, China is behind the U.S., I think that's actually very wrong. I think China is actually leading the pack when it comes to both AI, ML, and cybersecurity when it comes to cyber offense as well.
Very cool. Do you think BGP is a weakness of the internet right now?
It seems so, right?
Right. It seems to be one of the... when you were hearing about this this Facebook blog, did you think it was a malicious action or just a configuration
error? It could be both, right? I mean, it's very easy to mess this up and then lock yourself out, and then you're remote and you can go on site and you can fix it until someone gets in. And oh, by the way, your entire system and smart card and all the way to get into the building is now not working, so you can't even access the building anymore. Right? So I can see the ripple effect of depending on technology so much that you created a number of ripple effects, right? So it is possible, but it's also very likely, I guess, that it is a malicious attack. I guess I don't know if we're going to get the transparency, you know, because the impact effectively didn't impact loss of data or, I mean, it was loss of service availability, right? But it wasn't, supposedly at least, there was no breach of data. So there is no, I don't think there's a legal requirement to report what happened to anybody. So effectively, there might not be transparency there. If there is no PII, you know, or credit card information leaked or whatever, right, then that's just an availability thing. And look, I think when you look at how many people use WhatsApp and things like that, I mean, other things like Instagram and stuff, people can survive without it. But WhatsApp, sometimes it's used, you know, in very remote locations to save lives sometimes, right? That enable communications and get people to places. And so that potentially created loss of life.
Yeah,
who
it's
knows?
Becoming an utility. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, made me think about, well, maybe at some point we should have some paper fallbacks, you know, about routes and about configurations.
Yeah.
I mean, not everything should be, you know, depending on
at least
one.
I think a cold storage disconnect, right? I think you want to have, and that's, by the way, a huge mistake I see people make, you know, when it comes to backups. They have their backups on the same cloud. You know, if the cloud account is compromised, they lose everything. That's very foolish. You know, not having any kind of hot disaster recovery elsewhere, or at the very least, a cold storage where you have, at the very least, weekly backups. But can you even do weekly? Is that good enough, right? Are you okay losing a week of data in 2021, right? So and that process is expensive, right? Cloud providers are not doing very well when it comes to, of course, you can get an Amazon Snowball or whatever to get your data back and all this stuff. But having a daily backup process or maybe doing a backup of Azure on Amazon Azure, whatever, right, Google, you could do that. But even that, I think, is not enough. I think you want to have something local, right? Somewhere that you control, not on the third-party service.
Yeah, no, it makes me think about this. I don't know if you heard this SIP vault somewhere in Norway that
mm-hmm.
is, you know,
yeah.
under eyes saving.
Yeah.
We should have something like that with Wikipedia and, you know, these internet basics
mm-hmm.
protocols, very well defined, and even routing
tables.
They
used to exist for the big backup storage stuff, but with the rise of cloud, people are getting complacent. And I can tell you there's going to be, I'm confident there's going to be an event one day, like a Pearl Harbor of cyber, where people are going to wake up and it's going to hurt. It's going to be bad.
Yeah.
People should proactively invest in. It's so expensive to bring data, particularly when you have high volume of data. I get it. Mm-hmm. But at the very least, the critical crown jewels, bring this every day. And look, you have to put yourself in a position, you have to think about it. Is it even enough to have a day? You know, are you okay losing a day of data? Are you okay losing a week of data? What are you going to tell your customers, right? Or you know, if your mission is critical, can you do, what's the impact of you losing a day of data, a week of data, right? So.
Yeah. No, I read this fiction book about the potential effects of an EMP, electromagnetic pulse.
Mm-hmm.
And since mm-hmm. then, I'm kind of obsessed about that and looking at the sky and hoping that it's
the
not
the good news is most data centers, at least the modern ones, usually have some type of shielding to protect, usually. But you know, I'm more afraid of a cyber offense, okay? So... I mean, EMP, I install stuff at my house, actually, to protect from EMPs in my house, because I'm the same. I'm a prepper, you know, I'm crazy this way.
Very cool.
I have generators and, you know, everything I need to survive for 2 years if we lose power. But, you know, I think when you look at the state of the grid, you know, and you know, by the way, that happened after I worked at DHS for 18 months and I saw how bad the grid was insecure. And I can tell you it's a disgrace. It's very likely that someone can get in and create massive issues in the grid. And look, if you lose power for a week, people are gonna go nuts, right? That's not gonna look good.
The Purge. It's called The Purge. like mm-hmm. movie.
Yes.
Yeah. No. I read that book. It happened in Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds remote, but you know, it was subject to that same offensive. So.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Yep. So it's good to end up in a good note like this.
No, just kidding.
What's next for you, Nick? What's next in your career? What's next in your life? You're taking some time off. Do you have any ideas about future opportunities?
What's
for you?
Next? Yeah. So you know, I really wanted to spend time with my kids. You know, when I started this job, I had no kids. 3 years later, you know, I had twins and my other daughter. So I have three daughters under three. So it's interesting. And I missed a lot, you know, so I want to spend time with them. I spend way too much time working in DoD. So I'm going to do that. I'm also going to join a few boards, you know, just so I don't become too stale. And I, you know, I'm probably going to think about maybe doing a new startup. You know, I've done 12. I don't need to work anymore. So that's always good.
12 so startups.
You know, something around... Yeah, I sold 12 companies. Yeah, before this, and so you know, for me, that was also the benefit of going into the government with no conflict of interest, no need to make more money, right? So I don't care, right? So I do what's right for the taxpayer and the warfighter, and that really helped me a lot. And I think you know, for me, funny enough. Because of that, not many things keep getting me excited, right? It's like, yeah, whatever, you know, like some fields, I'm like, yeah, I've seen this, I don't care, right? But space, I think space is the only kind of market that gets me excited. You know, I've always wanted to go to space. So I think my next engagement will have to be something around space. So or around software and space, right? But it's going to be pretty. And you can think of, probably all of the stuff we talked about today brought as a service for space companies so they can focus on their mission software and they don't have to build all the platform, the DevSecOps, the GitOps, all these things and make that capable of running in space, right? And on the ground and have a mesh and have the connectivity and the security and the ability to push data, right? So that's the kind of stuff that I think can get me excited, but I promise one thing, I'm not going to sell back to the government. I hate, you know, if the government needs it, you know, whatever. But I hate when people leave the government and they come back to sell stuff to the government. So I'm going to focus on the commercial space side, not the government space side. So.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much. We don't want to take too much time out of your very deserved break. So I just wanted to thank you for your time, sharing your insights and for stopping by the podcast. Thank you so much, Nick.
No, thanks for having me. So exciting. Thank you so much. Stay safe.
Cheers.